This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're going to talk about in this episode include...
Rules skeptical GMs.
Lying maps.
30s New York book theft.
And Pythagorean miracles.
Robin, I just saw a tuxedo cat change into a red cape, then leap off the town hall clock tower. Have I been sniffing too much catnip?
You just saw a super kitty, Ken. We're not in River City anymore. Welcome to Meowtropolis, the brand new superhero setting for the Magical Kitties Save the Day RPG.
Super kitties? I thought being magical was already pretty impressive. You're telling me these cats have secret identities now, too?
Precisely. In Meowtropolis, your kitty is a caped crusader, protecting the bustling city from diabolical supervillains. We're talking secret hideouts, origin stories, and power quirks that add the earth-shattering kaboom to your series.
Sounds like the stakes just got a whole lot higher. And the best part... The Meowtropolis Kickstarter goes live on March 24th.
It's got a possum slate of rewards, too. We've got the Meowtropolis Hometown Book, the Trouble in River City Adventure Collection, and even a new solo puzzle book called Mice's Gambit.
This is obviously the one I've been waiting for, but Kickstarter campaigns don't last forever. We'd better pounce on those rewards before the clock runs out.
Head to atlas-games.com/backmeow to set up your launch reminders now. That's atlas-games.com/backmeow.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today in the gaming hut, we don't need those dice. We don't need those miniatures. Oh, and all we got is Takis, but we're still in the gaming hut, or are we? Robin, today our question is, if you're the kind of person who games without using the rules, are you still using the rules, or aren't you? What's going on?
Okay, so what I want to address, I have a salty theory.
Right.
So this is addressed to just a category of people, not you in particular, listener.
Me?
But I've noticed that on forums and so forth, when people are discussing rules, there is a type of person who will come along waiting to say, they're anxious to get this in, and they'll say, well, you know, the rules don't matter. And first of all, that's a typical form of internet discourse where you join a conversation to tell people you're uninterested in their conversation, because there's only one conversation on the internet at any one given time. So you have to tell people not to have the conversation they're having. But I have my salty theory is this, is that people who make this claim, the claim that rules don't matter, in fact, don't really use the rule set they are using very much at all. That for them, it's sort of an illusion, part of the unstated contract with the players, but that the reason they don't care about rules is they ain't using them to begin with. So to rebut that, first of all, Ken, you and I,
yeah,
we design rules on a regular basis. It's part of our jobs. And we both know that rules matter because we can design a rule that does one thing or attempts to do one thing, and then for whatever reason, decide to design a different rule to accomplish either the same goal or a better goal that was exposed when we saw what the first rule did. And we can tell that rule A works differently than rule B. Therefore, even in just our own work, let alone, you know, the work of competing designers or the work of design approaches that are at loggerheads with one another, rules just objectively matter. They make a difference whether you use one particular rule or another particular rule. Am I correct in that?
No, you're absolutely correct that system matters. This was the great debate in the 90s, back when we thought system was done being developed. And then we had the sort of generalized system matters debate. And I think to sort of steel man the other side, it was that the core activity being modeled in trad role-playing games was the presentation of a challenge, and that the core challenge was about, you know, was a little more survivable than not. And so you would be rewarded for role-playing your way to a solution to the challenge, and that if dice came out, they maybe came out to shape the narrative, but we all agreed basically on what we were doing, and whether you rolled dice pools or three dice six cumulative or a die 20 didn't really matter because we were all shaping the same sort of narrative. And then, of course, the instant we had the system matters debate, the golden age of story games emerged, in which the rules radically changed. People were attempting entirely different things at the table. Those rules existed to guide those entirely different sorts of things. And the art of role-playing was revealed to contain multitudes, and that rule systems, rule structures, even rules presentation enormously mattered. And I think a lot of people, especially people who sort of became very comfortable and very adept at doing sort of free form games, were sort of maybe caught a little bit on the back foot that the Berlin Wall came down while they were still ready to go, you know, fight the communism of over literal rules text. And then everything, you know, changed around them. So I feel like, yes, system clearly matters, and we have so many better A/B tests than we even had in 1999 to determine that. And then people who say rules don't matter are usually engaging with a sort of gestalt trad rule set in their head. And perhaps if you're a group in Sydney or a group in Melbourne or a group in Perth, your specific freeform approach to your memory of an trad rule set doesn't matter, because what's happening, what matters at the table, is the individual role-playing response of your players and your GM. And that is indeed a humongous part of the art and social activity of role-playing. So if I can steel man that guy's case, you know, it's true as far as it goes, but demonstrably it doesn't go far enough, right?
Right. But in addition to being, you know, we both think objectively wrong, I think it reveals something about the style of play of that person. And they are genuinely indifferent to new rule sets, whether it be a new edition of the rule set that they play or to a quite different rule set, because they have their way down. The invisible part of that sentence, you know, rules don't matter, is rules don't matter to me because I've got my rule set. And as you've suggested, that rule set is in that person's head. Their players are very happy to go along with that, usually because they're a strong GM who uses the fungibility of the rules in order to keep things interesting and keep things moving. So the trust issue that is dealt with by traditional trad rules doesn't apply to you because you've won the trust of your players. You know you're going to have a good time when you sit down at their table, and you just roll with that. And so the fine-grained differences between this rule or that rule, they don't matter. You've got your rules, you've overhead your rules, and you want to talk role-playing, but maybe you don't want to talk anything involving rules, which is why you've decided to say that in this debate. There may also be an aspect to this, which I think is just sort of the drift of critical terms, that just is the way, you know, terms like railroading means 12 different things, or, you know, Mary Sue has totally changed it of all usefulness in science fiction, for example, that people do sort of have a stock thing that they say in response to certain stimuli online. And that kind of player is, you know, that's just the first thing they say, which is basically, it again, I guess, sort of a more polite way of saying that this discussion doesn't interest me. And that's an even ruder thing to say, right? It's
right.
Stop talking about this. But at least if you say rules don't matter, you're changing the argument to a different argument, possibly one that you're interested in,
right?
And possibly not fully describing what it is that you're doing at the table to make rules not matter. So the other question, though, is for those of us who create not just rules of core books and so forth, but support material, are we making anything that these people need? They're active role players, they're participating in the hobby, they may be a staple at conventions, they may be someone who you really want to sit down at the table and play their game, but do we have anything to offer these people, or are they set? Are they good to go?
I feel like some of those people, and I know because of the places that Freeform is historically strongest, are also places that, for example, Call of Cthulhu is historically strongest for some reason, that I'm sure that those people are in their mind playing a new Call of Cthulhu campaign. So if a new adventure or campaign book or dungeon comes out, that they in their brain are playing that scenario or that campaign, even though they're not using, maybe they never touch the percentile dice, or maybe they do it every so often, but basically not remotely as often as the rules of Call of Cthulhu would say you should. And so I think that when we produce story material, and that you can define that as narrowly as a story, such as an adventure, or material that can be subsumed into a story, like a vampire clan book, you are producing something that those kinds of players can take in as grist for their mill. And I'm sure, I mean, I think I've met people who are so far down the spectrum that they have their own fantasy world that they've been playing in for 20 years. All their players love it. Everyone knows all the lore and myths of that world as much as they know the lore and myths of, you know, the Game of Thrones world or whatever else. And they're happy to just keep going. And this guy is still populating it with monsters that he's made up out of his head or is half remembered from Last Voyage of Sinbad, and everyone's having a great time. But I think short of that guy, and it is almost always a guy, short of that guy, you know, a new source book will come out and they'll say, oh, good, new monsters for the, you know, Theater of the Mind dungeon that I play. And they'll just, you know, excavate it for raw materials in which to form their Freeform. And then players who say rules don't matter because they're still playing Vampire First Edition and loved Vampire First Edition and don't need any new Vampire Editions, those players, I think, often, in the old days, certainly would harvest the books for story material and for new disciplines and things. Oh, I had never thought we could use Obfuscate this way. That's cool. We'll start having that available. But once the rules changed, either with, you know, Revised or Requiem or Fifth Edition, that's when, you know, their rules don't matter typing fingers are most primed and ready to help the online discussion careen into a wall as fast as it possibly can.
Right. And in that case, they're typing rules don't matter, but what they're meaning is the rules for Vampire One matter.
Right.
and the rest of this nonsense is just causing me cognitive dissonance, go away. And I think there's another interesting factor to the style of GM whose core rule book is in their head, is that sometimes, as you suggest, they are presenting it as, you know, free form. You know, we're playing Dave's rules at Dave's house with Dave. But in a lot of other cases, this is presented with the aesthetic facade of being not only an established rule system, but a quite complex established rule system. There are people who are very attached to something like RuneQuest or Champions or GURPS, and they're using about, you know, 3% of any of those systems. Uh-huh. Yet at the same time, they have an attachment to the idea of the complexity of those games, which they have entirely jettisoned in practice, but want to hold on to, that they don't want to. And I don't know if it's part of the magic trick of establishing trust with the players. It's, look at this big, thick rule book. There's everything in here, and I'm never going to touch it, and you're almost never going to roll a die. But don't worry, we're playing this game with encumbrance in it. Not that that will ever come into it, but shh. Or so whether this is a knowing part of the aesthetic preference, or whether the aesthetic preference for a complex rule set is bifurcated in practice, if not in thought, from what is happening at the table, and that's all good and glorious and well, and keep those rules complicated, because that's the feeling we all need to think that there are rules, even though I never use them.
Well, I want to single out GURPS, because playing GURPS with 3% of the rules is playing GURPS correctly. Steve Jackson has said many, many times that GURPS is a cookbook. It's not, you know, a Bible. You know, you don't have to use all of it. It's just there if you suddenly decide you need to figure out wind resistance on a pteranodon or whatever. But so the GURPS guy at least is doing it right. But I think that sort of you started by blaggarding DMs and GMs, and I'll continue by blackguarding designers, a lot of the people who are doing freeform games and rules don't mattering online are people who learned a rule set that was, let us say, incomplete or broken or not as good as it might have been.
Yeah, and back so, in the day, you had to invent your own core rules to be in your head. And if you had to do that, you're not giving them up for some modern Johnny-come-lately.
Right. And then in that sense, to them, the rules matter insofar as they are guidelines to the actual way to play the game. But the actual way to play the game is not the rules as issued in your three booklets or your initial book with the marble cover or whatever, because you started playing the game when the designers hadn't figured out which rules mattered. As you said, you and I beta test and A-B test these rules, not just in play, but also against each other. And we sometimes say, oh, that this is a better way to achieve that goal. Let's do it this way. Well, someone who started with our perhaps not as robust rule has already done that fix maybe in their head, or they've done a fix that works for their table. And they maybe are a little justified in saying rules don't matter, because if they mattered, surely someone would have gotten them right to begin with and not made me come up with all of my own headcanon as to how to keep people from, you know, dying when attacked by a cat or whatever.
Yes. The rules in my head, which are actually quite good, thank you very much, matter.
Right.
Is more characters to type, that's for sure. Well, one thing that matters around here is keeping it moving. So we're going to move through this exciting, beautiful, hand-tooled commercial and see what lies on the other side. Ballad Hunters, the gumshoe game of folk songs going supernaturally wrong on the gritty side of the Regency era, is on Kickstarter until April 16th.
Britain, 1813.
Across the island, the folk ballads of the common people are coming to life.
The dead walk, dragons rise, lovers betray one another, authorities condemn innocents to die. Whatever happens in the song happens in real life.
In Ballad Hunters, you play amateur folklorists working as agents of the crown.
It's up to you, armed with a little ballad magic, to decipher the clues in each song and keep people alive long enough to change the ending.
Designed by Tristan Zimmerman, whose spin on Gumshoe was so brilliant and radical, we had to create a new line for it.
You arrive knowing something is wrong.
You hear someone sing the song.
Reality bends to its structure.
You find textual interpretations, then act on them.
The GM responds in the spirit of yes and.
The ending is never guaranteed.
Singing at the table is optional, but encouraged.
Group singing is a joy, and Ballad Hunters is a perfect excuse to sing a song with your friends.
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press.
Sing it, Ken!
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press.
It's time to pull out our compasses, look at our topographical design here, and tell us where to go to get to the cartography hut. Yes, we're following a map to the cartography hut. Inside the cartography hut, we find this question from beloved Patreon backer Pagurus, who says, Ken once recommended How to Lie with Maps by Marc Monmonier. It's a very entertaining and informative read, but I wonder, is there a way to make one or more of the manipulation slash falsification techniques discussed there into a plot point for an adventure scenario, or an interesting problem to solve, or a surprising reveal at the end? Well, I guess in order to get to the reveal, we need the setup at the beginning. So Ken, get us started with How to Lie with Maps.
Right. How to Lie with Maps was first published in 1991. The third edition came out in 2018, not least because its author, Marc Monmonier, who is a geography and cartography professor at Syracuse University from 73 to 2021, noticed that in his classes, his students started raising their hands and saying things like, a paper map? They come on paper now? So he had to rewrite it with less emphasis on the physical form of the map and a little more emphasis on map production using computers and digital systems, because
the maps in our phone won't lie to us, not like those sneaky old paper maps.
Right. that now they're being constantly checked for truth by Google. And so the book, which is sneakily a introduction to how to learn with maps, what maps are, how to make them, things like that, had to be updated to involve a lot of digital maps and sort of the instant maps that we get on our phones, as you say. But the central thesis of his book has remained the same ever since. And that thesis is all maps lie because no map can truly represent reality. Every map is an abstraction. Every map is a generalization. Every map takes some things and puts them on the map and other things and leaves them off the map. And it is Manmanier's contention that a conscientious map maker presents the lies of their map as clearly and in as orthodox a fashion as possible so that you can't smuggle in extra lies. And he is very charitable and kind and says many lies are just blunders or just laziness, but he does say some people straight up lie with maps. And so a big portion of the lying part deals with statistical maps, maps that are meant to represent statistical data. So the number of drunk drivers in an area, the number of welfare recipients in the area, the number of gun owners in an area, the number of homicides in an area, all of those are data. And you can lie with those maps by picking the parameters mapped. So a dense distribution of data looks very different depending on the parameters that you set. So if you're saying, if you got 10% of the population is diabetic versus 20% versus 30%, your map is going to concentrate down on that middle part, maybe. But if you say 15 to 20 to 25, you're carving the data better. And he argues, you know, do your data scan, you know, do your data plot line and figure out where the natural breakpoints are to use that to measure.
Right. And this is a similar principle just to the way that people lie with graphs and tables.
Right.
And this is a map.
And a lot of this comes out of his inspiration for this book, a book called How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff from 1954. And by the way, if people are taking my recommendations for books, I would say that is another book that should basically be poured into your spinal fluid if you want to negotiate the modern world. So anyway, another way to lie with maps or statistics is to upshift from smaller to larger units. So for example, a county level data set, you upshift it to state level, you're definitionally smoothing those data because the, you know, the number for anything in Illinois is not going to be the same number across the map. It's going to make Chicago look good by comparison. Whereas whatever horrible social monstrosity you're mapping is probably strongest here in the great state of Chicago. And the other counties are maybe going to come off a little lighter, although there's some counties I'd keep my eye on. And you can do that with towns per county. You can do that with neighborhoods per city. Anytime you're looking at a shift up to a larger unit, you're smoothing the data, and you can do that in time. So the quarterly data make you look bad. Plot it over 10 years, see how you look. If your politician is doomed with a specific ethnicity, maybe shade it out to white versus not white and see if the numbers look a little bit better for them. Alternately, cherry pick your numbers per capita by quartile, absolute numbers or averages. And this all depends on what the map maker wants to say to you. And the map maker can say, this is straight from the data set. I did nothing to it, but they're lying to you with the statistics. And the map, of course, accelerates lies, especially lies of position and intensity, because of the way graphics work in the eye and the way that color makes or does not make things pop.
Right. And even the difference between an abstract graph and a map appears to be a measurement of objective reality, whereas a graph measuring the same inaccurate information still looks like an abstraction. So it fools you less.
And if you want to map something scary, you map it in red, and the darker red, the worse. And then it was like, oh, I don't like having all that dark red dot on my pristine town that I love. How do we get rid of it? Whereas if you want to map something that everyone likes, you map it in green. Oh, good. It's green. So if you're in a jurisdiction that's mapping their automobile break-ins in green, you know that they're up to something. Then you sometimes don't adjust the data for confounding values. So an age-adjusted death rate for a metropolis is going to be different. A city with more old people, all things being equal, will have a higher death rate. And so you have to adjust by age. And again, as I say, this is all just lying with statistics, but lying more powerfully because you're doing it with maps. the best sort of gaming applicable instant idea that you can have for a lie with a map is something called a trap street, Robin. And you or the listener may know a trap street is a fake street that you put on your map of the city to fool people who want to steal your map and copy it. And so if they copied your fake street, you can sue them for having copied your map. And that worked great, but they've stopped putting trap streets on because in 1997, the court ruled that a fake fact is still a fact and you can't copyright facts. And I feel like that's one of those unsung legal decisions that we need to, you know, start building huge portions of the economy on, frankly.
Right. And that is such a great idea that is rife with gaming applicability that we've talked about it already. In episode 314, we do a whole 15-minute on trap streets. So, Ken, what else you got?
What else we got? We have lying with transport maps. They show routes, but they avoid questions of frequency or convenience. Everyone is familiar with the map that says you get off the train here and you go to the other train here and they're on the same street, so it's the same circle. And then you realize that's a much longer walk than you thought. Transport cartograms don't even show actual distances or routes. So for like a subway or an L map, that might make sense because the connections are the only useful information. But for other sorts of maps, it's a little bit of a dodge. You're saying, hold on, it's a lot farther to the last stop than I want it to be. And yet here I am going along this evenly spaced line of eight stops. I don't like it.
Right. And sometimes that can be misleading, but not really a lie because you like the Toronto subway maps don't follow a scale because they need to fit in a certain space, the space that goes in the little slot on top of the subway car. So it literally says on it, this is not to scale, but still you're going to look at it, think it's to scale and think it's telling you something about the distances rather than just about the relationships between the stations.
And that's true for a great number of maps that have the transit in the central city more dense than the transit in the ring of the city. And that's just, as you say, you have to fit it all in the same map. Some places like the Bay Area Transit or New York Transit put a sort of a abstract, you know, set of islands. So you at least vaguely have some sense that things are where they're supposed to be. But if you compare the blob of Manhattan in the New York transit maps to the actual shape of Manhattan, you are realizing that Manhattan is much bigger on those maps than it is in real life. You also have sort of generalizing, as I said, you can't fit everything in a map. So when you're drawing a map, maybe you leave the thing that disproves your thesis off because it's small or it's a tiny amount of data. And so there's no reason to put this one area of bad soil into my soil map if I'm trying to sell a farm, because I'm doing the map by the whole township, not just by the acres that I'm selling. Or a generalization might elide a technical definition, like you have a contour line and say, this is the floodplain. And is it the floodplain? Floodplain has a very specific legal and insurance-based decision. And if you've just mapped the contour where floods often happen, that's not the same thing at all. And then sometimes you get a map where there are very disparate values across it. And if you are trying to sort of say, well, basically crime is the same across this whole area that our housing development is in, you just, you know, map it against the city as opposed to map the specific area and say, man, there's a lot of house breakings right where we're trying to build our housing development. That's a bad sign. And so it's just a matter of generalizing the map to omit an unpleasant fact is what often happens. And then sometimes you straight up draw the map to omit the unpleasant fact. So you're drawing a map to attract people to sell a project, whatever. And so you're leaving things off the main map. Like I said, you leave off the bad soil on the farm map. Or if you're selling, say, a housing development and it's next to the country club, well, the country club goes on your map, even though it's not in the housing development. We say, see, we're convenient to the country club. But if on the other side of your housing development is the sewage treatment plant, maybe you leave that off the map. And so the map is not lying straight up. It does not invent the country club, but it is certainly lying by omission because it's leaving out the less salubrious neighbor.
Or your drawing of the pig farm can make it look very attractive and agrarian, and then you buy the property and then you smell the pig farm.
Right, yeah. There's an example in How to Lie with Maps that he says, there's no map of smog for this transit plan. So you just have to imagine that this dense packed transit that everyone loves is just creating this gigantic amount of smog, or remember it specifically. The other way is to add a bunch of irrelevant or relevant details, even to make the map look complete and comprehensive when it's not. So if you're trying to say our railroad network serves the whole county and you put every town on that your railroad network is even near and you leave off all the other towns, then there we are. You've added the detail to do what you want it to do. He has a great premise, which I think should be, you know, on the cover of the book. Drawing trees on a map is much easier than actually planting them.
Yes, it might be a map of a plan to put in something, whether it's trees or a transit line or amenities. Or conversely, it could be outdatedness is another form of sort of unintentional lie in which, you know, you can be drawing all of these amazing rec facilities and this great school and stuff, and then when you get there, you can, that looked in really great shape in 1966, but now it's, you know, the school is abandoned and the pool is underfunded and so forth. So it's deceiving the user of the map, even if the desire to deceive is not present. And of course, Ken, there's the most famous example that everybody knows about how maps mislead, and that's our buddy Mercator is responsible for that.
It's the Mercator projection, which is a incredibly useful navigational map, and then made the shift to main map on the walls of places. And that is because, the argument goes, that the Mercator projection makes the British Empire look enormous, because giant stretches of Canada are all British red and giant stretches of Australia are all British red. And look how much of the world we control up in the empty north part. And if you are a anti-communist American and you're making a map of the global communist threat, then China and Russia look enormous on the map, especially Russia. And so you can see how beleaguered poor innocent America is, because even though Alaska's big, it's not Siberia big on that map. So it's important to have these maps that reinforce a political statement.
Yeah, so drawing of a landmass doesn't tell you how densely populated that landmass is.
Right. And we see this every time there's an election and someone says, land area doesn't vote. And then they get all steamy about how maps...
except for the U.S. Senate, which land area definitely votes.
It's still not land area. It's boundaries vote there.
Right. But what's in between the boundaries? Land area. You're splitting hairs.
I'm not splitting hairs. I'm making a powerful, powerful point that it is irrelevant to land area. Land area is a secondary quality of being a state. And if we had an imaginary state, it would still get votes. But enough about Delaware. The Peters projection, a guy named Peters, who was such a bad cartographer, he didn't even know he was doing the Gaul projection, came along and he said, I've fixed Mercator. I now have an equal area map, but my shapes are horrendously distorted. And they're horrendously distorted by coincidence in a way that makes liberal bleeding hearts feel good, because the UN likes Africa and South America to look enormous. And the World Council of Churches likes having areas where they have mission work to look enormous. Oh, look at all this opportunity we have. And so the Peters projection displaced the Mercator projection in a lot of well-meaning classrooms. And people got to learn nothing but in a new and exciting different way. The notion of the spherical projection was rejected by Peters on ideological grounds at the beginning of it. He picked his battle quite well and said, I'm only fighting Mercator. Spherical projections are sexist or something. I'm not even having this conversation. So that is a great example of maps that are meant to serve political ends, or that luckily serve political ends. In the case of Mercator, Gerard Mercator didn't care, but the guy who put that on the wall of every British and imperial classroom absolutely cared. And often you see maps that are lies in the sense of they're straight up lies. There is the famous War Aims map that you see whenever a war starts. This is what those monsters in Poland have planned for the Reich if we don't strike now. This is what the Hun has planned.
This is how far their missiles can strike. Look, their missiles can strike us or our friends.
Right. This is what the Hun has planned for America. We have to beat the Kaiser. And so those sorts of maps are basically just straight up propaganda, only again, in, as we've discussed, very, very effective map form. And one of the best things you can do on an enemy type map is have an arrow, Robin. You can have a scary arrow. If Stalin leaves Germany, look at that arrow. It goes right to Paris. If America comes after us, look at that arrow. It goes right into Beijing. Or you do the arrows to plump up our guys. Look at Patton's arrow crashing across the Rhine. Look at our boys arrowing away at the Gulf Coast, whatever it happens to be. People love to put arrows on maps because that right. gives you a sense of either threat, if that's the point of the map, or exhortation to continue the fight, if that's the point of the map.
Right. And there's even more overtly propagandistic maps that will have, you know, the enemy territory will be an octopus or something like that, or have an, the enemy will be an octopus advancing across the map. Also, and I guess we should start turning this into a thing where we offer the requested scenario hooks. And I think the best area for that is you have an old, outdated map that has lies on it as the people heading into the area looking for the thing, and you're either not going to find the thing you're looking for because it's been taken off the map. For example, Soviet maps famously omit a whole lot of things of strategic importance. And also, for example, UK maps of Belfast during the army occupation would leave out the watchtowers, which everybody in every neighborhood absolutely knew were there. They were dominating the landscape, but they weren't acknowledged on the map. So you are getting something as the explorers of an area that you just think it's an objective map, but it was there to either include details for a political purpose or to omit details for a political purpose. So, for example, instead of, you know, hiding the sewage treatment plant, it's the, you know, the horrible lake of fire has been left off because the people there, you know, who made the map didn't want to admit that the enemy god had created a lake of fire. Or conversely, the aliens who drew up this three-dimensional holographic map created a fake lake of fire so that you wouldn't go and disturb their sacred information repository. And so after a while of, you know, following the map to the information repository on the map and then discovering that there's, you know, predatory creatures there, you might say, well, maybe the lake of, if this lied, maybe the lake of fire is where we're headed. So puzzling out the intention behind an old map is part of figuring out how to get there and where to go.
And you can certainly imagine a map that is either enchanted because it's drawn by a wizard, and so it represents the territory in kind of a scary way. And then when the wizard says, oh, I think that there should be sunny little trees on my map, and he puts them in, sunny little trees show up in the world, so that you have the fake trees are presented, but because they don't have a connection to the goddess of the land, they're actually sort of empty-souled zombie trees, and that becomes a problem.
A sapient map could be literally lying to you. It could be something created by the vampire lords to not change in real time, because that would give it away, but to lead you into their trap. And so the map knows what you're looking for, knows what you want to find, and then sets itself in place. And so it's read your mind and it knows that you're looking for a pass through the mountains. So then it changes the map so that the pass through the mountains takes you through the camp of the vampire warlords. Or if you're looking for gold, again, it draws you into the trap. And so literally, you know, instead of trap streets, it's a trap map that is trying to lead you into trouble, and probably also lead you through a series of attritional encounters that will wear you down so that you're already banged up by the time you get to the vampire fortress.
And the map makes you think the vampire fortress is close, like the end of a subway line, but in fact it is far, like the actual end of a subway line. Speaking of the vampires, you can have the vampires, they run things, they run the map-making authorities, they run the papers, they run whatever they run. And so you're noticing that the map of blood poisoning or blood ailments is slightly different than the map of bone cancer or the map of other sorts of diseases. And that's because there are areas in the city where there are huge spikes in these blood diseases, but they have to be sort of averaged out in the whole district, as opposed to that one neighborhood where, darn it, everyone seems to be having pyemia, and we don't know why, but they do. And the vampires are like, we can't re just signposting where we live by mapping pyemia accurately. And that becomes who's manipulating the state health board or the city health department to do these maps that are misleading about the Paimia, and you get a hold of the real data and you run it through your own cartographic software, and it maps the actual data for the first time, and you get to see that, you know, cross hatching as Paimia is mapped against extra red blood cells, is mapped against all manner of blood conditions, and suddenly very specific dark loci show up on your map. I think that would make a fun, not the reveal at the end, but the reveal at the beginning of the scenario or the end of one scenario that lets you realize, oh, scope has gotten bigger, and here are all these vampires that are at work in our city, and we never knew because all of our medical mapping was done by suborned bureaucrats instead of by noble independent cartographers such as ourselves.
Right. And once you have decoded the map, you've now got a map to where the vampires are and you can start hunting them. Well, speaking of maps, I have a map of this podcast, and it tells me that there's another hut on the other side of this here commercial.
It's on the other side from the sewage treatment plant. Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tyne's famous clairvoyants divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep this podcast stacks unplundered by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Chuck Reynolds,
Michael Dowman,
Tequila,
David Flisk,
and Josh Street.
Ah, the smell of fine old paper, of leather and cloth bindings, of just a tiny snifter of brandy that you're sipping as you examine your vast bibliophilic holdings. Welcome us into the best of huts, the book hut. Ah, we could just be here forever, sitting in our chairs, sipping our, well, nope. But someone has come, tugging at our sleeves. Why, it's beloved Patreon backer Irene Dels, who wants this to become also a Tell Me More segment. Because in the Ken and Robin Consume Media a little while ago, Robin, you had read a book called Thieves of Book Row, and New York's Most Notorious Rare Book Ring and the Man Who Stopped It by Travis McDade. And Irene says, ooh, would I know more about book thieves? I hope it's as cutthroat a world as in The Ninth Door, or The Club Dumas, as the novel is, vastly better, in my humble opinion, titled. Leaving aside the question of titles of things, Robin, get us behind the title. Get us into this book row thievery.
Yes. So I guess it's book report day on the podcast. So
it is.
And Ken, this is either a book that you have either read or are going to read for sure, because it's yeah. Super up your alley as well. And this is very relevant to our interest because it's set in the 1930s. It's about stealing books. So basically, you can take a Travis McDade's book and just turn it into a New York sequel to Book Hounds of London. So in the 1930s, to a degree that we would all find mind-blowing today, very few U.S. libraries, and there's a couple of notable exceptions, which we'll get to, made any significant effort to protect the extremely rare books that they owned. And this was at a time when the collector value of books is suddenly skyrocketing. Particularly, there's the songwriter Jerome Kern decides to sell his book collection at this point, and the prices go right off the charts. But your average library, including quite big libraries, university libraries, local libraries, municipal libraries, whatever they are, they almost never do anything to keep these increasingly valuable collectible books off of their open stack. So they're just available for people not only to peruse or even sometimes to take out, but also, of course, to steal. And so this creates in the 20s and 30s a little mini industry of a few itinerant thieves and the many, many used book dealers who buy their wares, who are happily purchasing stolen goods and then selling them at their bookshops. And in particular, and also highly relevant to our Trail of Cthulhu interests, one of the main things that they're interested in stealing that are considered highly collectible and valuable are Americana. And so this is anything to do with previous American history, particularly things relating to exploration, encounters with indigenous peoples, local history. In other words, the very sorts of material that Lovecraft would put into his backstory, would have in the documents that you want to have that are player character handouts in the back of your book. These are the things that these dealers are essentially commissioning thieves to steal. And as if that isn't enough, Ken, the number one most desirable author, therefore the most desirable author to steal his work, is Edgar Allan Poe. So we've got our horror thing going on right there. A notable exception is the New York Public Library, which in fact does have a rare book section and does take care to protect their books and in fact have their own police accredited inspectors or have police powers and a rare book section. But even then, that's not enough to stop determined thieves from stealing things from them, because they have the fact that they have a whole room full of books that are too valuable to leave in the open stacks means they have incredibly valuable books. So when we read The Dunwich Horror, one is tempted to be sort of kind of sarcastic about, well, Miskatonic, they should know about the Necronomicon, where they're a little careless in their security. But actually, by realistic historical standards, Miskatonic is right up there with the New York Public Library in actually having some measure to prevent people from taking their books. So the place where you're going to want to set parts of this adventure is Book Row in New York City. And this is a section from 4th Avenue between Union Square and Astor Place, which at one time was just basically all used bookshops. It was the, I'm sure in your time machine, you go back there. There are little vestiges of it today, but it was, and used bookshops, even now in their dwindled state, are something that want to cluster together because the shopper, if he doesn't find what he's looking for at one store, will go on to the other and go on to the other. So there's a concentration. So if you've stolen a book from a library shelf and it's murmuring in your pocket, head over to Book Row, because eventually you're going to find somebody to buy it from you.
Yeah, Book Row is sadly gone now. It barely survives into the fall of Delta Green era. It's the 60s is the last sort of swan song of cheap rent in that part of New York City. And the rents begin to climb very rapidly on Lower 4th there. And so the bookstores are all selling out, leaving. The bookstore owners are dying. So if you're looking for a Fall of Delta Green sequel to your Bookhounds of New York story, that's when it goes. The Strand is often cited as the last survivor of Book Row. It, of course, moved away from Book Row, and that's how it survived. So yeah, it's gone now. It was gone when I was in New York in the 90s, certainly long ago, but much missed.
Right. And even in that period, the even fancier bookshops are already starting to move elsewhere.
Yeah.
But if you want your crooked book dealers, that's where your characters want to head. And crookedness is not just a matter of having books stolen, but also improving them. So there's a term that I love, which is still in use today, which is sophisticating, which is the process of taking a battered but valuable, say, first edition and making it less battered and more attractive looking by combining it with elements, say, of a later edition so that your first edition suddenly is in much better shape than it used to be.
And the London version of that is Grangerizing. It's the same practice that just was named for a different guy.
Right. And in this period in New York City, it's called, the books themselves are sometimes called Bennett copies. Again, after a particular guy, William Bennett, who was notorious for this. And these skills do come into play in the book theft ring, because if you steal a book from a library, it's covered in library marks. It may have stamps. It may have stamps not only in the front, but like every 10 pages. They might have special hidden stamps that the librarian can testify in court about if you happen to be hauled into court for stealing a book. There are also embossing marks, which are supposed to be hard to disguise, but aren't, because they're ironed out. And even perforations, there are ways to disguise those. However, not everybody is good at that as everybody else. And so often a stolen book will have, you know, badly removed stamps or a attempt to hide a perforation that is, you can see through it. And the other illegal thing happening at this point is that many of the crooked book dealers on Book Row, and especially in particular one of them, Harry Gold, who we'll talk about in a bit, are also selling what we today would think of as vintage erotica, but at the time was highly illegal pornography that could get you sent away for a lot longer than stealing a book from a library would. So they've learned to be criminal book dealers in a couple of different ways and to keep things on the down low. As I said before, the New York Public Library Special Investigator is designed to be a Trail of Cthulhu character. He's a multi-classer. He combines the antiquarian and the cop. And the very first guy was a guy named Edwin Gaillard. He started the position. And then when he retired, a gentleman named G. William Bergquist took over. He was famous for being sort of very friendly and warm-hearted. And his thing was always to try and convert the book thieves to the cause of good. But he certainly had lots of stuff on his character sheet, because he had been in the past a lumberyard worker, a cowhand. He was with the 108th Engineers in World War I France. He was a salesman and then later a librarian. So that's like half the occupations in the Trail of Cthulhu book that he could lay claim to. So the signature book theft that McDade revolves his extremely readable book around is a copy of Al Araf, which was a 71-page edition of Poe Poems, his second book published. It was brought out in 1829, and there were only 250 copies printed. So 100 years later, Poe is the most collectible author. Therefore, this is the holy grail of book theft. And guess what? The New York Public Library had one in their rare books collection. And so this became a target for thieves. And in particular, the more established book gang is run by Charles Rom and Ben Harris. They're booksellers who are so prolific at commissioning people to steal books that they eventually wind up with so many books they can't sell them or even house them. And that just tells you how many valuable books are in different libraries and how easy it is to pillage them. There's an itinerant guy who sort of runs a circuit that goes all the way from the Northeast to the Midwest. His name is Harold Borden Clark. He has a regular route that he steals along. He specializes in taking Americana. He's a famously prickly, weird guy. If you grab him and use your interrogation skill on him, he's pretty easy in revealing things because he can't stop talking and he doesn't remember the lie he told 5 minutes ago and contradicts himself. He's eventually caught, tried, deported to Canada, where he becomes one of the leading booksellers in the nation's capital, Ottawa, and kind of seems remained hinky throughout his career. But the guy who commissions the Al Araf heist is a guy named Harry Gold, and he's young and brash. He's one of the guys who's also peddling erotica, and he hires a bunch of people to steal particular things, including a first edition Moby Dick.
So he's like the Danny Ocean of this campaign.
Yes. And he, unlike some of these other guys, is enough of a Danny Ocean that he sometimes does the stealing part himself. And so he hires a guy named Samuel Dupree, who's a down in his luck Southerner. And he's the one who actually steals the Al Araf from the New York Public Library. So in reality, the cutthroatism Irene is looking for is kind of low-key. We're talking about they will inform on each other. In particular, Harold Clark was famous for offering to blow the lid open on the entire book theft industry. In other words, you know, rat on all of his competitors. And that was his reason for why he was caught with stacks of books is, I'm just doing research for my later expose. I was just about to come to you guys. But if we then start to think about, you know, what is in this Americana that people are stealing, it's actually not implausible to think that, you know, a little library in outside Pittsburgh might have a Necronomicon or a nameless cult, or that all of these Americana texts and maps and ephemera, like I said before, they're handouts, and they could have all manner of things on them. They could lead you to a Shoggoth lair. They could have a spell on them. And if people are commissioning book thieves, let's say an immortal sorcerer needs a new copy of the Necronomicon. Well, he sure knows where they are, and he can possibly, in a convention one-shot, he maybe commissions you as the ultimate Mr. Johnson to steal the Necronomicon for him. Or maybe he won't Johnson you at all. Maybe he'll reward you, and it's something else bad will happen.
Yes, well, nothing bad could possibly happen from trying to steal the Necronomicon for a immortal sorcerer, Robin.
Yeah, it won't try and bite you or anything.
He'll pay you in pirate gold, and then the pirate gold will come alive.
Yes.
Basically, we've got a handmade, as you suggest, Bookhounds of New York campaign, not just a one-shot, and just the reminder that Arkham and Providence are less than a day's train away from, you know, New York. Any of these guys can show up in your more conventional, staid New England Trail of Cthulhu campaign and draw you down into the Big Apple, the seedy underbelly of the Big Apple. Or you could have set your campaign or started it in Red Hook, and now you're expanding out of Brooklyn, and right across the bridge, there's Manhattan, and oh, nope, there's a whole trade in exactly what we have in Bookhounds of London. All the millionaires in America are living there on the Upper West Side. They're sending people down into the belly of Book Row to steal books, not just from libraries, but from churches, from archives, from patriotic societies, from each other, of course, because, you know, plenty of book thieves produces a demand for plenty of book theft. And that is what the whole campaign can be about. And it can get as Ninth Gate as you wish, or even, God willing, as Club Dumas as you wish, as little bits of Wendigo rituals that were written down by Audubon as he moved out across the West are making their way into collector sets of Audubon, and you have to figure out which of the Shrike drawings contain the Wendigo ritual that will call Ithaqua or do whatever it happens to do, while also turning you into a ravening, cannibal, unkillable monster. So there's no downside, really.
Yeah. You can also have a heist, the heisters scenario, where somewhere in the many warehouses that Rom keeps full of stolen books, the ones he's got too many of to move, well, there's the book that you need, the sinister one, the one that mutters in the night, and you have to get in there and grab it, possibly to prevent it from infecting all of the other books. And it's, of course, banned everywhere, but Harry Gold surely has a copy of The King in Yellow, so he can be your person that you go find that from, or, you know, if he's read it himself.
Maybe he has the copy that Robert W. Chambers brought back from Paris himself.
Yes.
Because Chambers is slowly dying of cancer now, and people are selling his library to fund their alcoholism.
So there's, like we said, that's not just a scenario, that's a whole campaign. So before we sketch out the rest of the campaign, let's see what waits for us after the final commercial of this here podcast. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at Yorktown.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at YourDadWillLoveThis.com. It's once more time to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to pause on the landing. We're going to wave to the porter of the fire salamander. Like any good elemental, he's going to give us a friendly wink back. And then we're going to head on in to the parlor of the consulting occultist. This time around, we're going to delve a little deeper into something we've talked about before. In episode 587, we talked about the Pythagoreans, but in covering the whole broad occult movement, we didn't talk about quite how magical Pythagoras was reputed to be. So Ken, let's remind people, Pythagoras, you know, you may know him from such triangles as the Pythagorean. What else do people need to know about him?
Just real fast, he's born probably around 570 BC on Samos, maybe as early as 600. He studied philosophy. Some people say he's the guy who coined the word philosopher, which would be cool. Traveled to Egypt and other distant lands. He was buddies with Thales of Miletus and the early scientists, and Anaxagoras and the early scientific philosophers, philosophers of reality. So he's in that mix. In 530 BC, he leaves Samos over politics, goes to Croton, Italy, and gets involved in politics. In 510 BC, there is gross political strife in Croton that burns all the Pythagorean community to death. And did he die in that? Did he escape and get hunted down later? Who can say?
It was such a big conflagration that we don't even really know what the beef was about. It was
right.
So disastrous, we don't know why it happened.
Yeah, they suspect it was some sort of political ruction and that Pythagoras was on one or another side, but whatever happened, he got the blame. The best version of his death is because he believed that beans held the souls waiting to reincarnate. He's being chased out of Croton by the bad guys, and he gets to a bean field, and he refuses to run through the bean field because it will endanger those souls, and they catch him on the edge of the bean field, and they kill him. And so that's anytime you like from 510 to maybe even as late as 500, it just depends. There is no possible way to know, but 510 is sort of the earliest that he could have died, given that that's when Croton blew up. So there we are. As we discussed earlier, he basically invented monasticism, may have invented geometry itself, certainly moved it ahead as the Pythagorean theorem, as we've mentioned. The Platonic solids, our dice, those are Pythagorean solids, so get back, y'all. Invented the octave and the concept of pitch, or again, discovered it and discussed it. So he invents music theory in the modern West, and numerology. He's the first great numerologist in the West, so he's all about that. He might have picked any of this stuff up in Egypt or in Babylon, where he theoretically went to study. Things that he taught, including the transmigration of souls via bean, are reincarnation, vegetarianism, physical culture, the harmony of the spheres, and of course, astronomy, architecture, geometry, and music, the four arts. So there we are.
So we're here then to concentrate not on his resume, and at least any of those resume items per se, but about the miracles that might be attributed to one or the various mythic capacities. So Pythagoras is also an example of someone onto whom legends attached. And a number of these legends will seem familiar and parallel other demigods or gods wearing human flesh that we might be familiar with. And one of the main things that you need to start your career off as a miracle worker is a miraculous prophecy to have harbingers harbinging you before you arrive.
Yes, the story goes, Pythagoras's parents are on a trip to Sidon from Samos, and before continuing on to Sidon, they stop off at the Oracle of Delphi to get the word on how the trip is going to go. And the Oracle says, one assumes mostly to Pythagoras's dad, that his mother is pregnant and that his mother would give birth to a man supremely beautiful, wise, and beneficial to humankind, and that he was the son of a god, possibly Apollo. So don't worry, Mr. Pythagoras's dad. Everything is copacetic. So that he is has a virgin birth attached to him. I did not, except for one case, sort of pick out which Pythagorean ascribed these various legends to Pythagoras. I figure we're going for a gestalt. But this is a post-Christian virgin birth that is assigned to Pythagoras. So just keep that in mind. At the Olympics, he reveals that he has a golden thigh, and everyone is very impressed. What exactly that means, no one bothers to explain. And
presumably not just a rad tan. That wouldn't be that impressive.
That he is maybe the son, as we said at Delphi, of Hyperborean Apollo, or perhaps just a reincarnation of Apollo or an avatar of Apollo. We don't know, but there we are. There was a great and famous magician named Abaris. He was from Scythia, and he had a magic arrow that he could use to fly long distances and also to rebuke spirits and whatnot. And Pythagoras got that arrow, and whether he got it because Abaris recognized him as the coming golden child, or he beat him in a game of riddles or whatever else, end of the story, Abaris doesn't have the arrow. Pythagoras does have the arrow. So he's able to use the arrow for cool magic.
And after bad things happen to him in Croton, that magic item is laying around for other people to pick up.
Laying around somewhere in Italy. He's taught by Orpheus. That's who teaches him wisdom and lore. And examples of his learning from Orpheus include that he, in an eloquent speech, convinced the people of Croton to give up luxury. At one time, there was a bunch of young drunk rapists, or would-be rapists, that were going to bust into the house of a woman known for her virtue. And he recited a sad song made up of long spondees, so words of two-footed syllables, and that became lugubrious and it made them sad, and so they did not continue their vile plan. At one point, he, speaking of the fava beans, always protect the beans, he persuaded a bull not to eat beans, and the bull didn't. And then, as sort of the second level of that same ability, there was a rampaging bear eating people, and he said, "Bear, why don't you eat vegetables? Why don't you be a vegetarian bear?" And turned the bear over to a temple.
I'm an omnivore. I'm halfway there. Sure, sure, Pythagoras. I love your spondees.
And he turned the bear over to a temple where they would feed him, one assumes not beans, but lots of other good stuff that bears like. And then finally, completing the trifecta, he called an eagle down out of the sky with his Orphic voice, just for scritches, just wanted to pet the eagle. And who among us, I would say, has not done that? After Orpheus teaches him, he then spends 7 years in the land of the dead. And this is the best quote that I ran across in the whole Apocrypha of Pythagoras. It's from Diogenes Laertius, and it says, "Pythagoras saw the soul of Hesiod bound to a brazen pillar and gnashing its teeth, and that of Homer suspended from a tree and snakes around it as a punishment for things that they had said of the gods." And that's a story hook right there, that Homer and Hesiod were covering up the truth of the gods with their stories, and that the real truth is, well, it's about being bound to a brazen pillar or having snakes in your tree. So it's pretty great. But when he comes back from the land of the dead, he told his followers what had happened during those 7 years that he was away. So they were amazed at his wisdom. There is, I think it's Herodotus. You've
been doomscrolling this whole time while you're in the land of the dead? That's pretty awesome.
Right. And I think it's Herodotus that said, or he just hid in a cave and would sneak out and find out what was going on. So for people who say Herodotus was never, ever
an
skeptical.
Original fun ruiner, Herodotus.
So amongst his other Orphic lore, he could cure disease by playing the lyre, specifically by singing Homeric hymns at the disease. You knew all the magic properties of plants, and he would tell all of his followers those properties.
He sometimes averted plagues rather than waiting until people were sick in order to cure them.
Either by big singing or by big planting or by some other magic. He could tell the future. His favorite kind of future telling was hydromancy, where you look in a body of water and see the future, but sometimes he could do it in fire. And he also had a big prophetic wheel that he could spin that would tell him the future. So that's fun. The image of Pythagoras moving from town to town with his roulette wheel spinning a fava bean with someone's soul in it is almost irresistible at this point. He can command spirits and would sometimes command them to go into water, so he was all very good at that.
Among his predictions, he once predicted that a dead man would be found on a ship, which seems, because it's less impressive, sounds like it might actually be based on something. It's right. Not the typical sort of back projection of let's think of miracles and attach them to Pythagoras.
If you're looking for your series of historical detective novels, this can be the first adventure of Pythagoras, where he finds the dead man on a ship.
Yeah.
He was crossing the river Cosus one time, and the river Cosus said, "Hey, Pythagoras, how's it going?" And everyone was very impressed by that. He could calm the waves of the sea and could walk on water, just like Jesus could. So good for you, Pythagoras. When he arrived at Croton, the sort of first miracle he did was he told the fishermen exactly how many fish they had caught. He said, "You've caught 153 fish," or whatever it was, and they were all impressed.
Right. I'm surprised they weren't annoyed that he made them count their fish.
But yeah.
I guess Pythagoras was charming.
You sing a song that says, "Counting fish is fun, let's all count the fish first."
Yeah.
And then he makes his guess, and then he says, "Would you like to play roulette with your winnings?" And anyway...
And then I'll guess your weight.
He was bit by a poisonous snake, but don't worry. He bit the snake right back and injected its own venom back into it and killed it. So That's a story about Pythagoras's saliva glands, if it's nothing else.
Right. Well, as we learned in the mythology quiz, there were people who believed that everybody's bite was highly poisonous. So I guess that's how you find out you bite a snake.
Right. Well, Pythagoras's was double poisonous because it had snake in it. He could recall his former incarnations. And so at one point he walks into a temple and on the wall he sees a shield and he says, "Oh, I used that shield in Troy. I was the warrior Euphobus." And everyone says, "Oh, you were not." And he says, "I wrote my name on the back of the shield," and they took it down. And sure enough, it was. So they were the ones who looked the fool then. He could bilocate. He is seen at Metapontum and Croton at the same time, or in some stories at Metapontum and Toramenium at the same time. So either he does it twice or he could trilocate, and that's been the buried lead this whole time.
Right. And in the stories where he survives the warfare at Croton, that's, you know, if you can bilocate, that's a pretty good way of bipping out of a mass violent situation.
Just fade out like Luke Skywalker. He had second sight and clairvoyance, which I think comes from he was in the land of the dead for a while, but he could see what was going on in the world. But also he could talk about what was going on in other cities, and maybe he was cheating by bilocating there, or maybe it was genuine clairvoyance. We don't know. The sort of people who like round numbers, which I guess is many numerologists, say that he lived exactly 100 years, which is where the 600 to 500 lifespan sometimes comes from. And this is people who use the Christian calendar who still like Pythagoras and round numbers, of which there were many, as we discussed previously in 587. And then finally, Robin, you'll be glad to know that he continues to reincarnate to this day, and that he was Merlin and Francis Bacon and the Comte de Saint-Germain, and just maybe the Maharishi Mahesh Yoga. So Pythagoras inspired the Beatles to play groovy sitars instead of fun guitars. So there we are.
Right. So that means that someone could come along now and in your weird contemporary game or horror game and claim the latest version of Pythagoras and start to bite snakes and get talked to by water and divine the future with hydromancy. And you might be the ones who need to shut that down before he causes another Croton.
Right. And if reincarnation follows the numbers, which I guess it doesn't have to, he's 16 because the Maharishi Mahesh Yoga died in 2008. So there we are. He could be like Superboy getting his miracles and magic in before he has to sort of give them up and be respectable and guide mankind through its next
miraculous turning. And full of 16-year-old testosterone. That's a whole set of problems you'll need to solve.
It's a good combo. His golden thigh is on Instagram even as we speak. Or TikTok, I guess.
Yes, he may be looks maxing.
Right. He's probably looks maxing definitionally, because Pythagoras was looks maxing even in the 6th century. He may have invented looks maxing is, I guess, what we would say.
Well, if TikTok has a new show your golden thigh, that'll tip us off and we'll know to look for him.
We can figure it out.
Well, having turned the miracles of Pythagoras into an up to the minute with the contemporary lingo story, we can duck out of this podcast, but we'll duck back in a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast out of the underfunding triangle by joining such backers as
Nate Merritt,
Urs Blumentritt,
Ethan Mr. E. Schoonover,
Jack Gulick,
and John Bisco.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.